Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
We're in the book of Vayikra, known as the book of Leviticus. Verse 1 through chapter 5. Yours stops at 6, verse 7. Mine stops at 5, you know, at the end of the chapter. Yes, ma'am, what is your question?
Now we have Jesus, but before, these people didn't have Jesus for the forgiveness of sin. But Jews don't have Jesus even still today. But they're not keeping all this today.
Right.
Why?
That's a great question. That's a really great question. It's a long answer, too. I'll try to make the answer relatively short, but it's a long answer, so bear with me. I should just flip over. Oh, okay. Her question is that if you notice all these offerings required for Leviticus, and it continues on, there's more details in the following couple of chapters regarding these offerings. There's offerings for guilt, there's offerings for sin, there's various other tasks which you do. And of course, she points out, well, the Christianity, they cling to Jesus the Messiah as their offering, as their sacrifice, in place of these things. But the Jews don't receive or don't accept him as an offering, as their sacrifice, but they still don't do these things. So how do they handle their sins, transgressions, of things that they do, their guiltiness, without having Messiah and without doing these offerings? And that's her question, which is a loaded question because there's lots of stuff in there. And I'll try to make it as succinct and straightforward as I can. But it is an elaborate answer. Christianity and Judaism teach this same principle. They use the different words, but it's the same principle. All right? This principle of good versus bad. The principle being, if you're a good person, that's good. If you're a bad person, that's bad. It doesn't matter if you believe in Jesus or not. If you're a bad person, you're still bad. In Christianity. In Judaism, it doesn't matter if you worship the one God there is in heaven. If you're still bad, you're bad. It doesn't make much difference. So both of them teach the same principle on this philosophy. That the idea is to worship one God means to obey his instructions, which is to be good. Now, they have different definitions of what good means. Some have good for more elaborate definitions. Judaism has a more elaborate, more defined definition of what good is. Christianity is a little bit more open-ended. I mean, they use conceptual ideas, but without a lot of heavy detail on what good is, as far as every example. But they still idea is good. Judaism today teaches this basic philosophy that everything in the world that human does is balanced between good and your bad. Every person has good things they've done. Every person has bad things they've done. Judaism today says we don't have a temple. We don't have an offer. We can't pay for it. As far as heaven is concerned, as long as your good outweighs your bad, you'll be okay. So a good is heavy, lots of good, and very little bad. Then heaven will say, okay, Messiah, God, actually, if they say heaven, not really the creator, but heaven itself, which is all the angels, will say, okay, we are accusing you of all these bad things you've done, but you have other defenders accusing you of all the good things you've done. If the good things outweigh the bad, you get to stay in heaven. If they don't, there's a few options, otherwise you're going to hell. That's the modern day Jewish instruction regarding good and bad actions. It's not terribly different from Christianity and their philosophy, too, but let's discuss that in a minute. Yes?
Well, I thought that the Jews didn't believe in heaven and hell.
Oh, quite the opposite. They do. They're the creators of it. The Gehenna, where we got that idea as far as going burning in hell, yeah, Judaism created that philosophy. The Greeks ran with it, but Judaism created it, that you will be destroyed or destruction, go into destruction. Not the Greeks reformulated it as burning in forever and ever, forever tormenting. Judaism turns it, no, you just destroyed. Neither hell is destruction. It's not a, you live in destruction. No, you're dead, dead. You're actually permanently dead. As opposed to Greek philosophy, well, no, you're just permanently in pain for the rest of all eternity, which is the hellfire, and the other words for it. That's a different philosophy. In Judaism, the teaching, modern day Judaism teaching is, when you're dead, if you're balanced, if you're scared, if you're worse than you are good, the basif outweighs it. There's a few minor options you might be able to fix, but usually you can't. You are dumped into death. And your spirit's wasted. It's done. It's done with. That's how they deal with these issues. Because they can't correct an offering anymore, which we'll discuss more about this today. Yes, Diane.
I'm listening, and I was just reading each. So the Jewish view of sin is each person has the inclination to do both good and bad.
Correct.
And then modern Judaism teaches that human beings are not basically sinful. Is that it?
No. Human beings are basically sinful. Their desire is that. But human beings must control that based upon our instructions. So our instructions are our Torah instructions. You must control it. We still have the same inclination of doing things that are rotten. But if we do not control it based on our parents instructing us from a child onward what control means, which means the Torah, yeah, then you would be off in your never land of badness.
Sin or chet or chet is the result of our human inclination.
Yes.
The yetzer or yitzer must be properly channeled or balanced.
Yes,
balanced. That's what you're
saying.
Yes,
controlled. Yes, maintained. Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, that is a correct modern day instruction what they do. Now, Christianity. Oh, yes. So go ahead. Your another comment. Make him run. He's your husband. He can.
Well, there's some sects of Judaism that actually believe in a form of reincarnation.
There are a few. You're absolutely right. There are some sects that believe in reincarnation, which is I won't go into those because that's crazy. Sorry, that's just crazy. I don't discuss crazy things. Yeah, there are some sects of reincarnation. In the philosophy being, the way this is described is, you go into heaven, and if you failed your human lessons, which means you focus, like they gave example. Here's an example of a rabbi. He died, all right? Rabbi dies. His wife's, mournful, sad, too bad, wish she lived, yada, yada. Then she dies. She goes up in heaven, she sees her husband, who died at a young age, sitting there teaching hundreds of old men, their spirits, about the Torah. And she asks him, wait a minute, you died a young age, but you're teaching these old men. How is this possible? He says, oh, my dear, I've lived multiple lives. You see, I was with you because of my first life, I studied Torah and didn't have a wife and a family. I died and God said, go back and study what it's like to have a wife and a family. So when that was done, that's the idea of reincarnation. They send the soul back. That is garbage, but that's the philosophy. I don't usually teach that stuff because it's crazy. But anyway, that's how they deal with good and bad. Modern day Judaism. Christianity deals with it a little bit differently, but the same principle. In that if I do bad things or good things, I'm still balanced or still judged by it. But the idea in Christianity is, now this is not all Christianity, this is the basic concept of it. Don't get wrong, I'm not trying to point fingers or poke holes at people. Basically, Christianity is that if you did more bad things than you did good things, and you still believed in Jesus, but you still did more bad things than good, you're still going to hell. That's the same. The difference being, instead of destruction hell like Judaism teaches, it's burn in fire hell forever. So it's pain. It's suffering forever. I'm not sure why they felt the need to make suffering forever, but they did. So that's how they describe it. Yes.
I was just actually reading about this week. It was the Catholic Church. There's different degrees of hell. Mm-hmm. And I was learning about that this week. That's how all this stuff get messed up in all the different religions. But it's basically just men's ideas of what they think God said in the scriptures, but it's all messed up.
Right. That's an accurate statement. It's all really messed up. Was it? Dante, yes. Yeah. Yep, that's pretty much how it works. It's a strange... It's a creation of men's imaginations because In our world, if someone does something very evil, we think death isn't good enough punishment for that individual. It's too merciful for that individual. That's how human beings view things. We think of, well, the Hitler's of the world. He died. That wasn't good enough. That wasn't enough punishment for what he did. We want to punish him more. That's it, to inflict greater pain. That's the idea. We come across these ideas and these, we create these envisions, these imaginations. God determines what's punishment, what's not. And he says, when you're dead, that's punishment. Because there's nothing else. And when you're dead and come back, that's different. That's not a punishment, that's a blessing. Yes.
Well, that you get into the whole thing of vengeance.
Yeah.
With that.
Vengeance, that's correct.
Of vengeance, that we don't think death is a good enough punishment for certain egregious things. But having said that, in the Eastern Orthodox tradition, at least, to them, the difference between living in eternity with God in blissfulness versus what we would call hell is that when the resurrection happens and everyone is going to be with God for all eternity, either you're going to be with him in blessing and joy, or you'll be with him for all eternity, but if you are not prepared for it, then being in his presence will be torture.
Torture
because
you
don't want to be there, because you didn't live your life wanting to be there, so why would you want to be there later on?
Mm-hmm.
So just being in his mere presence is torture. It's not like he's roasting you on
you're
a
trying
spit.
To create
just being in his presence, if you didn't
right.
want to be in his presence when you're alive, when
right.
you're resurrected after death or whatever, you're still not going to want to be in his presence.
So to be there
will be torture.
Either way, you're still tortured, so to speak. Yeah. The different philosophies. So I hope this explains a little bit as far as how Judaism deals with these issues. They base upon your actions, whether you're good or bad, and that determines whether or not you heaven forgives you or allows you in or says, no, I'm destroying you. Christianity teaches very similarly. The idea, of course, Christianity, that, well, Jesus paid you for your sins and all that kind of good stuff, but you still have to live a moral life. Whatever that means, that's the idea. Each sect has their own definition of what isn't moral, so it's a little muddy there. But Judaism is the same thing. They have their own muddy variations of what isn't moral. That's how they deal with these issues. Because Judaism doesn't do sacrifices, and Christianity doesn't do sacrifices either. The sacrifice they do have isn't well used. It's not well used. The sacrifice of Messiah is offering isn't well used by most Christianity. They use it in a vision or a fashion, which is not incorrect, but it's insufficient for what it's being used for. But we'll discuss that a little bit later. Hope that answers the question regarding how Judaism does this, how it deals with these lack of sacrifice offerings. Yes, Anne.
I noticed it says in many places a person sins and then becomes guilty.
Yes.
So what's
When you sin, there are two different groupings of sin. There's a sin unintentional and sin intentional. You intended to do it, you wanted to, you chose to, you knew about it, or, oops, I had no idea. Whoops, that was a mistake. Both, you still made a mistake, but you deal with them both differently. You are only guilty of the whoops, I didn't know, when you find out about it. Does that make sense? So say, for example, think of some sin. Who cares? King David made some mistake. He counted people. He wasn't supposed to, but anyway. He counted people. A lot of mistakes people make. So he makes a mistake, and it's not pointed out to him at the time which he makes the mistake. He makes a sin. Later on, when the sin's pointed out to him, he realizes, oh no, look what I've done. He then is now guilty of it. Prior to it being pointed out to him, it's just sitting there waiting for it to be discovered, to be made known. Now, God, of course, is the one who's in control of what is and isn't known, and what time it becomes revealed and what time it does not become revealed. So God may say, yeah, I'm holding on to this one for a little while. I'll reveal it to you later, when the time is right to expose it. For example, the sin of King Saul, when he slaughtered all those people of Nob. The priests of Nob. I think it was Nob was the name of the town. It was a great sin. Horrible sin. Murdered a lot of people. All I'm doing was godly things. Murdered them all. But it wasn't paid for. No problems. No problems. Many years. He passed on. Doesn't pay. Not until David becomes king does God say, now this is being paid for. You're paying for it now. Of course, Saul's descendants had to deal with it. And was what was the girl's name? Oh, the concubine who, I forgot, anyway. It's one of Saul's, no, it was Saul's concubines. I can't think, it starts with an R, but I've forgotten her name. Anyway, so the son, Saul's sons are killed for Saul's sin. Now, it was done many years later, but it was not made known to David or anybody else what had happened until an event occurred. Oh, we need to now address this sin. The guilt didn't apply at that time, it applies later. Does that make sense? So when you become known, it's because when it applies now versus you didn't know about it or wasn't aware of it before. Yes.
Yeah. What about in verse 3, or chapter 3, verse 17, it says, you shall not eat any fat.
Yes.
Now, I understand, I think I understand about don't eat the blood, but how do you avoid the fat?
When you go through the list of what is cut out, the fat around the inner sections, which is a lot of belly fat areas, other parts that are your internal parts, and the flanks, the description of the type of fat that he's burning up the altar, because the peace offering, the feast peace offering has all these fat that's cut out and put on the altar. A lot of fat that's on the animal isn't listed. There's a small amount of fat underneath the animal's skin, but they don't take that off. You notice they didn't list that on the list. The list they listed was thick fat that actually exists on most animals. So if that's the list that goes up to God and you don't get to eat it or don't consume it, that must be the fat he's referring to when he says don't eat the fat. Because he didn't talk about any of the fat, the marbling that exists inside of various forms of meat. Birds have lots of fat on them. Have you eaten a chicken? There's a lot of fat. There's chicken fat. We call it chicken fat. It's very greasy. There's a lot of fat on animals. The fat that he's referring to here is the fat he explicitly points out, this is what you're cutting off. It's these sections that I do not wish for you to eat. Does that make sense? Okay. Anybody else? Yes. Larry. Sorry, say that question again.
The reality of this good, bad balance.
Good, bad, yeah, we'll discuss a little bit more about it when I get to that section regarding offerings themselves. I just want to give the general how Judaism deals with the basic concept between how to deal with the fact we don't do the offerings anymore in their way. Oh, a follow-up question?
I always thought that the offerings really, from a practical standpoint, fed the priests and the...
In a practical standpoint, most of them did. That is true. That's just how they would end up being used. But also into how often you brought them. So, for example, I may bring an offering, a sin offering, for example, once a year. Well, how often do I sin? By the way, I sin every day. Who knows? How often it happens. But I'm not going to bring an offering every single day. First of all, I get broke really quick. But I'd offer an offering because it says here, laying your hands on it. It does two effects. One, it's you are putting yourself on as if this animal is you. You're transferring your soul, your strength to it as if it is you that's being killed. And the second is you're confessing all the various sins this animal is addressing and taking care of. So you may have sins for your wife and yourself and your kids or what? Who knows? Whatever they list, I list them all off. Some argue whether it has to be out loud spoken or can be internal, just thought of. I don't know. I'm not going to bicker about that. But the point is you're transferring all this list, whatever it is, to this animal. It may list a whole lot of them. I'm not sure how many sins you did that year or how often you do it. Mind you, every holy day an offering was offered, a sin offering was offered for every holy day. Not Shabbat, but every holy day it was. So anytime you went before the God three times a year, theoretically, you'd offer at least three sin offerings a year. That's how it would need to work. But each person had their own way. They made their own way of life. Both make sense. Any quick questions I can answer before I jump through this? Oh, yes. Louise, go ahead.
I have a comment. An awful lot of blood at the base of that sacrificial altar.
Yes, there is.
How many years did this go on? How many people were it? 6 million people, whatever.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
That's a lot. They had one altar that they did this with. That does not necessarily mean they had one altar which they burned animals on. When Solomon's temple came around, he had the one main altar. But as historical records indicate, they burned animals on many of them. Which means one was dedicated for the blood application, and then they burned the animals on all of them as they were going through the process of going through all this. Because there were a lot of animals being processed. When Solomon built this temple, there was also water cisterns under the temple that would always continuously wash and flood and clean things. So water was continuously flowing out of the temple. During holy season, the water was frequently red, for obvious reasons. But during the rest of the time, not quite so often. Now, when the kings came along and Solomon comes along and they offer 1,000 sheep and or 500 cattle and they're feeding thousands and thousands of people, yeah, there's a lot more blood going on, a lot more altars, a lot of things happening. What this one historian argued, no one can prove it because no one was there to watch. One historian argued is that instead of taking each of the animals and doing the same process each one of them for the blood, they would take the king's offering alone, his one animal, do his blood and transfer as if they did it for all the animals. That's one historian's argument. But again, no one was there, you can't prove it, so he could be talking out of the whatever it is he thinks of. Who cares? But that's an idea. Yes?
How many years is this going on?
The number of years was going on in the altar was in the tent format, the tabernacle. 440 years, roughly. That was continuing on, that it was in the tent form. About 400 years, a little over 400 years. And then from King Solomon till the destruction was another almost 400 years too, as well. So it's a long time. So you have about 800 years worth of use of this process every year for the thousands of people that go through this. There were a number of years during various kings, when the kings kind of made the temple go into shams and not care about, didn't do anything with it. It was obviously not done at that time. And also during the Nebuchadnezzar came through. Yeah, exactly. At that time, they didn't do it because the temple was not functional, not usable. Does that make sense? So any time which you were not physically there, it didn't happen. But most of the time, with those exceptions, it generally happened for about 800 years total, roughly. Not exact. Don't quote me on the exact years. I have to sit there and do the math to figure it out myself. Okay, let's move forward this week. We've got a short Torah portion because we have a new moon to go through. All right, we're going to begin. I have my little... Does this thing work? There it is. These are charts we have written up here. I didn't write them, sorry. We took photographs of them. Different types of offerings. Back. No. Thank you. The right, wrong button. I keep doing that. Where's the light button? Thank you. Okay. Yeah, exactly. So there's sin. This has a little grouping down here is sin offerings, and there's other offerings good for sin offerings inside and outside for what's being offered. You will notice we discuss various offerings through this process. The various offerings have different applications in how they're processed. Some, as you pointed out, Larry pointed out, as far as the priest eats them or his family eats them or consumes them. Some he does not eat or consume. You notice the ones which he does not, the sin offerings in particular, we're just focusing on those right now. The sin offerings doesn't eat and consume anything that he offers himself for himself, the bull, or the community offers for themselves, which is also a bull. The priest, the community, does not consume it, but they're processed the same way. So that he, the high priest, and the community, as far as God's concerned in sin level, use the term sin, it's the same processing, same status, same standard. Why is that? Why would God say, the high priest, you sinned, that is the same as if the entire community sinned?
Yeah, I don't like that.
Yeah, that doesn't seem right? Yeah. Say that a little louder.
He's the representative.
He's the representative. The high priest is the representative of the whole community. So if he sins, it's as if the whole community sinned. It's the one and the same. The high priest represents all the congregation of Israel before God. He's supposed to stand there. That's his job, to stand there and represent everybody. So if he sins, he brought everybody's sin upon them. As you recall back with Eli, when Eli sinned with his sons. Yeah, exactly. Eli sinned with his sons. He made all the community sin. Well, not everybody did everything that they did. It doesn't matter. Because all their offerings just became worthless. If my high priest is a sinner, I say, here is my sin offerings. Okay, yeah, I'll cut this up, spit the blood out, burn this up. Okay, have a good day. Is God going to say, oh, I received your sin? I atoned? Of course not. Why? Because the high priest himself is guilty. He has his own sin to have to clean up first. You have to have somebody who is pure to offer your offering in your place. It doesn't work if the person themselves is standing there for their own sins. Hence the idea of our Messiah being sinless. If he's standing for God saying, God, I'm covering these people's sins, and God says, son, you have your own sins to pay for. You can't cover anybody's. Well, that would be worthless to me. He might as well just step out of the way, because I don't want to pay for his sins too. You need somebody who is clean, who perfect to start with. Hence, the high priest has to pay for their own sins before they serve offer yours. If they're not clean to start with, your offering is bupkis. It's worthless because they themselves are dirty. Yes.
Reminds me of what Yeshua said when he says, take the plank out of your own eye before you take the splinter out of someone else's.
Exactly. The same principle. And that's what winds up happening. So if you have the high priest who represents all the community and all their sins he does, all their offerings, he takes care of all of it, if he's unclean, all their sins are also unclean and worthless. All the offerings are worthless. The sin offering listing in chapter 4, discusses the bull of the priest for the first 12 verses or so, and then from verse 13 through 21 covers the congregational verses as far as for their sins of chapter 4 of Leviticus. So in the community is the same way. So this community did some sin. Well, the community represents all the people. The community represents your representative for your family, the head of your household, which may be your tribal family. It represents the judges of tens and fifties and hundreds. All those are the community leaders. If they themselves are sinners, then again, it affects all of us. Our sins aren't taken care of because our whole community is in corruption. It's not useful. It's not practical. This is why it's very important in modern-day Judaism to teach us heavily at Tikkun Olam, the healing of the world. The idea is you must take care of not just yourself, but the people around you too, that otherwise it affects you negatively. If everybody around you is a sinner, you standing alone doesn't make you perfect. Because good doesn't corrupt evil. Rather, evil corrupts good. No matter how good you are, if the world around you is corrupt, you're going to become corrupt over time. You can't maintain perfection because the world around you is unclean. So in Judaism, they teach, wait a minute, you want to take care of yourself, that's important, but make sure you take care of the people around you too. Don't ignore them, else you'll be corrupted with them. So the idea is address everybody and deal with all these issues as a community. So again, the community, if they're affected poorly, you're affected poorly. Does that make sense? So God says, high priest, community leaders, you're the same. You both will affect the people the same way if you're both corrupt or damaged or unclean. So straighten yourselves up, and then everybody else will then follow suit. Because you're supposed to be leaders, supposed to be representatives, supposed to do the best you can. And it trickles down, the idea trickles down to other people. That's to do with sin offerings. Now, of course, I won't go into all the details regarding the different kinds of offerings and the fact there's goats and there's sheep and there's, if you're poor, there's the birds, or young pigeons. And the bread offerings, those are different forms of offerings for people who are, for sin offerings in particular. People who have their sin, they can't afford the expensive stuff. Because poor people sin just like rich people sin. They're no different. But it doesn't mean the poor people notice more. Yeah, if rich people sin, they do notice it more. Maybe that's why the animal's bigger. that's it may be more noticeable because they're more known. Okay, next sin I'm going to talk about. Oh, yes, go right ahead.
What does the frankincense represent with the bread?
Ah, that's the mincha offerings. Now, in sin offerings, the bread, when somebody offers a bread for sin offering, no frankincense is allowed, no other oil is allowed for sin, because of sin offering, only the flour itself. But in grain offerings that are not sin-based, you have oil as well as frankincense mixed in with it. Well, why is the frankincense mixed in with it? When you're burning it up, because When the high priest takes a chunk, now if it's flour, he takes a 3-finger handful of flour and burns in the altar. The rest of it he can consume. So in that 3-finger handful contains a portion of the oil and all the frankincense is all burned up. The frankincense isn't mixed in with the rest of it. The frankincense is all mixed in with this oil and it's burned up for a savoring or sweet aroma. That's the idea behind it. It's a pleasant offering. The smell that comes with frankincense. Frankincense is a healing oil. It's designed for healing. And what you're offering up is a healing oil. God, thank you. Heal me or heal my family. Whatever, those type of ideas when you're offering it up. If it's flour mixed with oil. It could be baked as well. If you pre-bake it, see here I'm offering this loaf of matzah, whatever it is. He just rips off a chunk of it with frankincense, mix the chunk, and that's burned up. Frankincense does not stay with the rest of it. He eats the rest of it on its own time. It's unleavened bread, so it's pretty, pretty dry. Don.
So if I am reading this correctly, he says use three fingers, right? But in most of those cases. But then he says in one of them, at least he says, three fingers in your palm.
Palm, yes. In some of your translations, say palmful, or the handful of it, but how it fits as three fingers into the handful. So some people debate as far as how much is permitted to take. It depends on the size of the mincha offering. Some sizes are permitted to be big, and some are permitted to be small. Depends on their size. So if it's a large offering, a large deep pan, or large, it's a big offering. It's a large structured piece of loaf that you're offering. Then the three fingers full isn't enough. You take the handful of it, which is the three fingers with, you take the three fingers ripped apart, and it fills the palm, and you burn that up. If it's a small offering, just three fingers full, and dispose of it that way. It depends on how much is offered. You'll notice in the list, which I have, my remote control went away. There it is. Which button does it? It's the. There it is. So this burnt offering. This is the blood applications. Flour offerings. Okay, so mincha offerings. There are fine flours and mincha, challah offerings, all these different things. Quantity of flour, 1 to 60 isseron is a unit of measure. All these values, how much can be inside the offering. They vary some. So if you have 1 isseron, it's a very small amount, you're a very poor person. If you have 60, it's a large amount, you're a wealthy person. But not wealthy enough necessarily to give an animal, this is an offering you're choosing to give. So depending on the size of the offering dictates how much the priest, the memorial portion gets burned up the altar goes up with it. The objective isn't feeding the priest. The objective is what goes in the altar as a memorial portion. That's the goal of the person who's offering it. The priest, it's a secondary thing. He just consumes the rest of it. The goal is what goes up into that portion. Is a human's objective to offer it. All these various others mixed with oils, and there's some are fried on griddle. There's the different pan types, baked in ovens, smeared with oil. There's a lot of different types which you can do, different offerings, different options for what you're offering up. This is where we get, as Tam pointed out earlier today, how we get bagels from. Because you can burn them also, boil them in water as well. See here. They also have offerings for scalded hot water, baked and fried. We have either bagel. there's also mixed in scalded water with also baked and fried. These isrons wheat for the different kinds. There's induction offerings. There's the offerings for the priests themselves. A sinner's mincha, which is just plain flour alone for just a general sinner. Sinning applies for a jealousy offering. Someone who's a jealous of their spouse, thinking they cheated on themselves or whatever, that kind of offering. They have raw flowers. You also have the Omer offering, which is the count of the Omer, which is a one log. A lot of different options, right? A lot of different sizes of grain offerings. The most common offering given are grain offerings. Because how many people are rich? A certain number. How many are poor? A bigger number.
Probably a lot.
The bigger number are poor, the offering they're going to give is going to be flour. So most offerings are grain-based offerings. Not every offering is fixed to being wheat alone. You have barley offerings, other grains too. But they all have their purpose. They all have their symbol. They all have their meaning. Deanne, your hand was up.
Well, I don't understand the memorial thing.
You're giving to God. That's where the frankincense goes in. The part the memorial means the part you're giving to God as a burnt offering. That's that memorial portion is to Him. It's His portion.
Memorial is like remembering things,
yes.
Right?
He remembers who?
Me?
Yeah, the person who's offering it. Now we discuss the idea, now we've got the base idea of what offerings are. What do they mean? Why would I use one over the other? What's the difference between an Ola offering versus a Shalemim offering versus a Mincha offering? Why would I choose one? What does it matter? Everything. It matters everything is in what you're choosing. Well, it figured you would be able to realize it by how it's being used. And To be fair, I'm just being honest. I'm truly being honest. That's what how you do it. To be fair, the idea of these various offerings, some have been understood over time, meaning that people learned what the offering was by watching and observing what the prophets explained regarding them. The prophets have been observing offerings for a very, very long time. They know what they came from. They know what they're used for. This is for that reason. This is for this reason. They discuss some of them. Not every offering, but some of them. So discuss a little bit about some of these choices. The offering which I didn't talk about earlier was the Olah offering. The first one, Leviticus 1, has the Olah offerings beginning. The Olah. Olah means all burned up. Yeah, or high in Spanish. Yeah. Burn up. You burn up the Olah offering. Who offers an Olah offering? Anybody. Anybody can offer an Olah offering. What? This is the first offering. This is the free will offering. Free will. Not from sin. This is your giving, your offering up to God of your choice. You are choosing to do it. Not from a sin you committed. Not because you feel guilty for some reason. You are offering this guilt, this offering up. It's completely burned up. No one eats it. This is not an eating offering. This is all burned up. The only thing that's saved out of the burnt offering, if it's from a cow, sheep, or a goat, is the skin, the hide. And that's given to the priest. Everything else is consumed up and burned up. There's a free will offering. There's other free will offerings too. The mincha offerings are all free will offerings as well. Why would I choose an Olah offering versus a mincha offering? Mincha offering is the grain offerings. It's also, now this grain offering, part of it's burned, a piece of it's burned, and the balance of it goes to the priest. So part of it's burned, the memorial part, and then part of it's also the priest eats. No. Burn. This is burned up into smoke and ash. Because a mincha offering can be pre-cooked, a loaf of bread, already made. That's still legit. But this part that's completely burned up into ash. So that's been burned. So, I did a terrible job of spelling mincha. Mincha. That's better. They're both free will offerings. They both have different functionalities, meaning how they're used. Why would I choose this one, Olah offering, over the mincha offering? We thought it was cheaper. Right? So a little bit of grain versus a whole animal? That's a huge difference, right? Why would I want to, they're both free will, it's my choice to give. I choose to give one. What's the purpose of this offering over that one? Any ideas? The difference. Why would you choose, they're both choices, if I say, hey, person number A, a letter A, you want to choose which offering you want to give. The guy says, I'll flip a coin. He does the best he can. That's a big deal. The best you can. Yes, Pat.
To honor God with the very best you have and to give him, so that he knows that this is a sacrifice for you to give something that's special.
That's special to you. Yeah, you choose the best. And if it's valuable to you, it means more. If it's not valuable to you, doesn't mean as much. What's the point of that, right?
Okay, so what was your question?
Why would you choose one over the other?
Financial reasons
you would choose? Yeah, if you're poor, you would have to choose the mincha. What if you were rich? Why wouldn't you just choose mincha anyway? It's cheaper. Right, that's what the best, you're choosing the best. Your free will offering, these are all free will. God said you don't have to come give these. If you're going to give something to me, what are you going to give? You're going to choose to give your best. It's the best you can.
That will be burned up.
It gets burned up or the priest consumes it. If it's a mincha offering, the priest consumes part of it as well. Yes, Adrian.
I was going to say it's kind of the same principle with why it always has to be without defect, because otherwise it'd be like, well, I want to say,
That one hobbles anyway. A little bit. I can't use it anyway. Yeah. You give the garbage stuff, which I forgot which prophet it says, but rails against that problem. I forgot which one. You give me the garbage stuff instead of actually what's valuable. Clearly, you don't value what you're offering me. So you get the best you can. And Olah versus Mincha to choose one or the other, which is the best one that you can give. Now let's discuss about the details of an Olah versus a Mincha. Who gives and who is being taken care of? We'll discuss these next. So in the Olah offering, if you notice your Bibles, it uses very specific words. It's not happenstance. It was the Olah offering first. That's a terrible color, never mind. I won't choose that one. I better off with the same with black. So Olah offering first. It says when a man is going to offer an offering. The first part when the chapter 1 discusses. It says, verse 2, speak to the children of Israel, when a man among you brings an offering to the Lord, to Jehovah, for the animals, the cattle, flock, or you bring the offering as your free will. So, the man, Adam. Yeah, this is not gender specific, but the man is supposed to offer on behalf of his family, which would include his wife, his daughters, who aren't married, and other, it would be ideally for the whole family. There are a lot of widows, and they'd be either under their father's household, or if they're too old, it'd be somebody's household, a son-in-law. That would be the idea is the man does it. Usually there's a man somewhere, somebody's got a male, hopefully. Adam, he offers it. If you look carefully at the Olah offering, there's something strange about it that's not the same as the other offerings. I bring your attention to it. He saw continuing on, for he should skin the offering, verse 6. Skin the burnt offering, cut to pieces. Sons of Aaron, a piece replaced on the fire, arrange the wood. They should arrange the piece of the head, the fats, and the wood, and all the fire, blah, 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 blah. Instead of the flock, he continues to go in smoke, but the verse is an atonement offering. There it is, verse 4. He leaned his hands upon his head of burnt offering, become acceptable for him to atone for him. The Adam, the man, is offering this Olah offering, whether it's from cattle, flock, sheep, whatever, or even birds, is an atone offering. That should ring little bells in our heads. Atone offering. Isn't that the goats? Yeah, the Day of Atonement, right? Well, those are for like sins you did intentionally. That's the Day of Atonement about, the atonement for sin. Why on earth is an Olah offering associated as atoning for the man? Man's bad. It's a strange offering. Because if this is referring to an atonement offering, well, shouldn't that be under the sin category? I made a sin, therefore the atonement's for my sin? That should make sense, right? That's what you would normally think of as atonement. Yes, Jeff.
Shouldn't you always want to live under God's covering?
Ideally, yes. We're going to discuss next. The process which the person lays their hands on the animal does two things. All right? Task feature number one. The animal used to be your animal. You brought it. You either purchased it or you raised it, whatever it may be. When you're laying your hands on it, you are transferring your identity to it. So if it dies, it's as if you died. All right?
Of your relationship.
Yes. It's a relationship between you and the animal, and the animal and God, and you and God. It's a continuous relationship situation. So when you put hands on the animal, you're transferring, God, I'm here alive. It's as if this animal is me. I'm putting my hands on it. I didn't confess sins. This is not a sin offering. This is an atonement offering. It's a little different. I'm identifying this animal as if it is me. Now, I'm going to slice it open. The person who's put the hand is the one who kills it. And the priest will collect the blood. Now, the life, the soul, the animal is in the blood. That's where it is. That's where this life is in the blood. So the animal became me, representative of me, and then I killed me. poured my life into a bowl. The priest comes on with their life, the bowl, they put on the altar, and they pour the balance of it at the altar. Then this animal, which is representative of me, is burned up on this cut up pieces, which I'm cutting it up. I'm with the assistance of the priest, telling which parts to cut. I'm cutting it up. I'm doing the whole processing as if it is all me. And I am transferring it to be burned up. The idea of these free will offerings is to attempt to connect or come near to God, you as a person. If I, Daniel, just walk over the temple and say, I'm coming in to open the doors, what happens to me? I die. I can't just do that. But I want to show God how much I love him and appreciate the wonderful things he's done for me, not because I'm a sinner, but rather because I'm grateful for what he has done. That's how these offerings are then used. These are grateful offerings for what you've done. It's as if I am pouring myself out, my life's put out to God, and going up in smoke to God as if God and me are now as one, as a gratefulness to being God. Have you ever hugged your parent? Ever hugged your parent? Usually we have hugged our parents when we were little kids, right? And they want to be part of you sometimes, if they're in a good mood. It'd be attached to you. The same principle. You can't do that to God, can you? You can try. Good luck. It doesn't work. But this is the closest you'll get to by saying, God, this is the best I have to offer up to you, as if I, me, is going up in smoke to you. That's not my sin. Rather, this is my offering to you. To be at one, or cover at one tone, be at one with God. That's the idea of the Ola offering. Yes?
It sort of reminds me of baptism.
It is similar in its nature in that way.
My understanding is that when choosing these animals, they just didn't go out to the herd and pick one. These animals were brought in as household pets.
Sometimes, yes.
Well,
not
that was
always
my understanding. Yeah. They were household pets. And as such, it enhanced the loss.
It's more significant.
And when you laid hands on it, that's when the animal recognizes the trusting relationship between.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I heard that, then I thought that was astounding.
It is. A lot of, if the archaeology has demonstrated that the house they used to build, the house with the upper section, the animals were beneath the house frequently, like the bottom floor. So it was the house, they weren't like massive, you know, 10,000 head cattle ranches. These were one or two animal households. They had a few animals to work with, that's about it. So there's not a lot of money here. They are like a pet in that way, because they're very, very close to the animal in that way. Every day, oh, is the animal sick? How's it feeling today? You're always concerned with the more work you put into something, the more you love the thing you put into it, the more dream you have for its success. Yeah, they did. Just love this. So, hence the Ola offering is an important, valuable, significant offering. Hence why someone would choose it. Now, as opposed to a mincha offering, a grain offering, it's not the grain isn't valuable or isn't important, it's a lower cost offering, because not everybody can afford the animals, but most people can afford the grain offering. So grain offering is the best you can do, the best you can afford to. The portion that's burned up is done in your name, hence the frankincense that goes up with it, is done in your name as your relationship with God. The balance of it, the priest eats, so you don't get a benefit from it. But the grain offering, the part that gets burned up as your burnt or memorial offering, is the same idea as your Ola offering, if you did an Ola offering. But that's just that portion, it's a small, significant piece. Hope that makes sense. Why someone would choose one over the other? Kind of like a hug to God. Say, God, thank you. Yeah, like kind of like a hug to God. A thank you hug. I love you. You're kind. You're generous. Not because I'm a sinner. I need your forgiveness. Rather, just a thank you. All right, let's move forward.
Daniel?
Yes.
Just one thought. As was mentioned to me, perhaps you could think of the Ola offering as, Ola!
Well, that's just wrong. all right. Let's move forward. Let's see here. The next offerings, which I want to bring your attention, which are, I can't say more significant, they're just different. There's a characteristic that mincha and the shelamim offerings. The shelamim offerings are the feast peace offerings. Have anyone ever been to a festival? Is there food usually served? Yes. Okay. That's a feast peace offering because you're sharing it with people. So when we have Passover that we share the meal with, that is a feast peace offering. When we have Days of Unleavened Bread, which we share our unleavened bread with one another, that's a feast peace offering. There's a lot of feast peace offerings that are given up for various reasons. They are offerings that everybody gets to eat. Not just the high priest, but everybody shares amongst what is being offered. So shalomim or feast peace, shalomim. It comes with the word shalom for peace, but shalomim is many pieces. Or not chunks, but rather many enjoyments. This offering is discussed mostly in chapter 3. And chapter 2 discusses it too. These shalomim and mincha offerings have one characteristic that's attached to each other. Mind you, when you're looking at mincha offerings, they span a wide range of applications. The mincha is like the blanket, covers everything. Specific ones, ola offering, a shlemim offering, sin offerings, those are very detailed specifics. So mincha offerings are covered all, they cover everything. Hence, because a poor person needs to cover everything. You can't have only rich people pay their sins paid for, or only rich people get to offer God. The poor get to do it too. So the grain covers everybody, and then there's specifics for certain categories. Nefesh. Have you heard the word nefesh before? What's nefesh? What is it? Spirit, your soul, your breath, your animation. Nefesh. I can't spell it either. I'm just guessing. N-E-F. Is it P? I always do F. I'm not a PH person. That's too Greek for me. Soul, your breath, your spirit. It's your animation. It's life. Because if I'm moving, I'm alive. If I'm not, I'm dead. So, your animation, you got a soul. You're not. You're dead. That's why it's disguised as, are you breathing? Are you alive? Are you moving? Yes, then you're alive. That's good. Hence the term animation. You can move. It's also the reason why plants are not considered having souls, because plants don't move unless the wind's blowing against them, but by themselves, they don't have their own animation. I'm not saying I'm not trying to get a theological argument, but that's what Judaism discusses, that plant life is not considered, you don't mourn for a plant, you don't pay for killing a plant, it's not a death penalty or a sin to murder a plant, it's not a living soul. That's how they get the idea. Anyway, let's move forward. So, nefesh, anybody who offers a shelamim offering or a mincha offering, their soul, the nefesh, is what's offering it. I'll say this again. The shelamim offerings and mincha offerings, it's your soul that's offering it. The ola offerings, it's your man or your body. Yeah. The flesh. It's your soul that's doing it. It discusses this. It says what a soul does this. A soul does the mincha offering. The verse 2, chapter 2, verse 1, says when a person offers a meal offering, it is when a nefesh offers a soul. Verses, chapter 1, verse 2, says when a man, which is actually an Adam, a human, not an ish, like a male, but rather a man, Adam, which includes male or female, but it's Adam, the male body itself. Verse chapter 2 and chapter 3 are all based upon the soul. So it's chapter 4 for sin offerings. They're all soul-based offerings, which is your animation, your life. These are your life offerings. The reason why you live are these offerings. This is what you're offering to God. As opposed to the body offering, the man offering, you wish you were close to God, but you can't be. It's a little different. You wish you could be there, but you can't. The soul offerings aren't that way. They are God treating you as if you are with Him. It's a little bit different. It's a philosophical belief. It's a viewpoint change. That's all it is. But it shows that it's an inner being of someone that's doing it. The mincha offerings, the shlemim offerings, the sin offerings, they're all your soul offerings. Because why are you doing them? You want to live. You want to live. You want your soul to continue on. Your goal is to live. The other one, the olah offering, is treated as if you want to, you're okay with this life, but you want to be with God now. The body's all right, but it's not. The life is okay, but I want to be closer to God instead. It's a better life. It's a different way of which you view these offerings. There's nothing evil or great about one or the other. They're all different. They all have their functionality. So when you do a shalemim offering, a mincha offering, or a chata offering, which are our sin offerings, they're all your souls doing it. Have you ever felt shame? Have you ever been ashamed of something? That's your soul. So your body. Your body doesn't feel shame. It feels, ouch, it feels hurt. I can hurt me. But I don't feel shame. I don't feel ashamed. A body can't do that. A soul, on the other hand, most certainly can. A soul feels those things. When you read a Torah, and the Psalm says, "May I think Psalms 119, I read your Torah and I will not be ashamed." Means I'm reading the laws and I'm not, my soul is not ashamed for not following these or doing these laws, these instructions. I don't feel shame. Was that nefesh? Yeah, yeah. When you're convicted to do something, that your soul is doing it. I'm going to do this because it's important to do. Not because you're hungry and your body needs feeding. You're not going to eat my dinner because I'm hungry. That's not the nefesh. That's the soul doing it. That's your body saying, I'm hungry. But I have a drive to go do what is right, what is good. It's not for your body. It's for your soul is driving it. That's the nefesh, your animation. I'm going to go do this. So as we deal with these issues, when it is with mincha, shalemim, which is the peace offerings, your peace offerings, you're giving to other people. You're sharing. Not because they're all hungry, but because you want to share. It's the idea of sharing with them, to spread out the wealth, to spread out your sharing. So you're offering. Mincha offering the same idea, because you're sharing in this case with the high priest. The idea is, it's your inner being to want to do this. It's not your body needing it, but rather your inner being needed it. Yes?
Daniel, can I say today, because we do not do these offerings, may I offer that these are different types of prayers that we offer up to God?
We're going to discuss that in a few minutes. Yes, okay. We'll discuss that in a few minutes. Most Christianity, you're absolutely right, Christianity does not follow these at all, right? Judaism does neither. They don't have a temple that they burn with. That's completely untrue. Completely, patently false. That people don't do these today. Every person does one of his offerings at some time if they're following God. It's not about the physical animal. It's what you're doing that distinguishes it. Because the animal itself isn't the thing. It doesn't matter if I do a goat or sheep or a lamb. That's not the point. It doesn't matter if I do this amount of grain or that amount of grain, a bigger piece or a little piece. That's not the point. It doesn't matter if I'm sharing, did I do enough of lamb? Was it enough to share? Did everybody eat enough to eat? That's not the point. What are you doing with them? What's the symbolism behind them? How do we act out or do those things, those activities? That's what matters. So we'll discuss those next, for the next 10 minutes or so before I call a break. Because if we go after this, we'll go into our new moon. I'm going to bypass... I can't do that. Sorry, I can't bypass that. That's important. Sorry. I'm going to jump through a few basic details, all right? So... I'm gonna skip the intentional sins because that's not really matter. That's a later chapter. Yeah, intentional sins aren't important. Well, they are, but not this, not today. All right, we'll do this real quick, but we'll cover it all as best we can. Fair enough.
Okay.
So I have all these various offerings, mincha offerings, all grain offerings, regards salt, no exceptions. No exceptions. Everything else we call is salt. Go to Mark chapter 9. Mark chapter 9. Discuss what salt means. It's as the Torah says, salt of your covenant, as it requires there. You don't forget the mincha offering has to have a salt for the covenant you have with God. It's an important aspect. Mark chapter 9 discusses this in greater symbolic detail, starting in verse 42. let's see here. This is Mark chapter 9, it's verse. You know what? No, I'm going to skip that first story. That's not terribly important. It's about. But 42 is it? I'll do 42 because it leads up to it. So verse 42 of Mark chapter 9. Whoever causes one of these little ones to believe in me to stumble, it would be better for a millstone we hug around his neck and we're thrown to the sea. If your hand makes you sin, cut it off. It is better for you to enter life maimed than to having two hands to go into hell and the fire that should never be quenched. Where the worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. If your foot makes you sin, cut it off. It's better for you to enter life lame than having 2 feet be cast into hell, into fire that's never quenched, where the worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. If your eye makes you sin, pluck it out. It's better for you to enter the kingdom of heaven of God with one eye than having 2 eyes to be cast into hellfire, where the worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. For everyone will be seasoned with fire, and every sacrifice will be seasoned with salt. Salt is good, but the salt loses its flavor. How will you season it? Have salt in yourselves and have peace with one another. That's the point of it. His tail in there is the point of what he's talking about. What is the verse 42 about the whole, against the little one, or cutting your hand off, cutting your foot off, plucking out your eye? It all boils down to everyone's seasoned with fire, everyone's tested, everyone's measured, and every sacrifice we season with salt. So every salt, every sacrifice, every offering is measured. Every offering is weighed. Weighed against what? The covenant you have with God. And God instructs every mincha offering, that's verse 13 of chapter... what is it? Every mincha offering, every grain offering has to have salt with it with no exceptions. I forgot which verse it was. Chapter 3? Yeah, verse 13, chapter 2. Sorry, chapter 2, verse 13. Of Leviticus chapter 2, you shall offer your meal offering with salt. You may not discontinue with the salt of your God's covenant, for upon your meal offering, on your every offering, you shall offer salt. That's Leviticus chapter 2, verse 13. The point that every covenant offering, it's part of your God's agreement with it. So when we're dealing with salt, and Messiah points out that everybody is seasoned with fire, which is all the offerings are seasoned with salt, you're all tested according to what you did. What is your part of the covenant that God's agreeing with you to do? What is your part doing? Did you add salt to it or not? You're going to be tested under these fire conditions. Whether you're tested or not, that's your business. Because all the offering is burned up in fire. Everything's burned up in fire. That's the point. Burned up in fire. Being tested with fire. Your offering's tested with fire. Again and again and again. Salt is included. Why? Because that is the agreement, the covenant you got with God. What's salt used for? To season. And to preserve. And also to destroy. Salt corrodes many things. The same agreement is designed that way. You do it well, just the right amount, it seasons. A little bit more preserves. A little too much, it corrodes. So God's covenant will check you whether you're seasoned well, not seasoned at all, or over-seasoned. You did too much. You went beyond your accepted tolerance or what you should have done. You're always measured. The salt agreement, how salt works, how the covenant works. You either follow God's agreement or you didn't. Two options you have, there's no third, that's how it works. So, salt mincha offering, you are tested. Salt is tested against the covenant of God. That's an important testing, because that's what you're offering to God. Here's God, here's my portion. I test this. Yes?
Daniel, we're coming up on a covenant offering here pretty quick. And if I have aught with my brother, is God going to accept my offering at Passover when I take of the bread and the wine?
Or, if you have a what with your brother?
If I have aught with my brother.
Oh, an aught.
If
okay.
I'm at odds with my brother.
Against him. Right.
You know, I'm thinking of Matthew 18.
Right. If you fail the test of this of these agreements, because having a spat or an unrighteous argument with your brother... You broke God's covenant. That's not acceptable. So your assault was... I can't speak for God's behalf, but the rules here of mincha offering would say, of course not. But I can't say that God's going to do that, but the mincha offering, his instructions would say, of course you wouldn't accept it. It wouldn't be worth anything because you didn't settle with your brother first. So it's not a value to you. It's no different than the high priest saying, okay, I'll offer your offering up, but I'm going to sin on before I get there. It's the same thing. There's no difference. What value is it? It's worthless. It becomes junk. It's garbage. Don't bother. You're wasting your time. So that's according to the instructions as far as how we understand them. Now, I can't speak for God's behalf and just say what was written down. I can't go beyond that. Anyway, let's move forward. So the salt offering, mincha offering, it's about covenant testing with God. That's what you're being tested on. Hence, salt is on every grain offering. Poor or rich makes a difference. Let's move forward. Mincha offering. Everything is unleavened. All mincha offerings are unleavened. Even Passover, even non-Passover time. All of our unleavened mincha offerings. Does that mean you can't offer a leavened loaf? Not as this offering you cannot. You can offer leavened loaves on other offerings, but not grain offerings to God. Why is that? Again, the salt covenant. You're being tested. What does leveling mean? Puffed up. Are you puffed up when God's measuring you? You better not be. You ain't nice and flat when he's measuring you. Just what you are, nothing more, nothing less. Hence the salt testing, the unleavened testing. You're expecting God to measure or weigh you based on whether you're puffed up or whether you're not puffed up. You can lift up as an offering leavened bread, and even sweet leavened bread, but not as a mincha offering. Those are offerings as first fruit offerings. For Shavuot, it's offered. Any other offerings, even any time of the week or the year you wish to offer it, that's not a mincha offering. Those, a puffy loaf is acceptable, but not under these conditions. If you're wishing God to measure you or weigh you, you don't want to be puffy. Nice and flat. It's a bread of measure of weight for what your actions are worth. Humble, that same principle. Humble without sin. Let's move forward here, because I'm running out of time already. I won't discuss the wave sheaf offering. That's in chapter 2, verse 14 and 6 through 16. It discusses about the type of grains and such and what you can do. We'll go that some other time when it comes to wave sheaf in a couple weeks. Let's see here. In Hebrews, you all have read many times, I'm sure, Hebrews chapter 13 discusses offerings that are outside the camp. Hebrews 13, verses 9 through, was it 16? Let's go there real quick. Read it not too fast, but read it well enough to know what's being said. He is paraphrasing a phrase in Hosea chapter 14, which I don't have to go there necessarily just yet. Hebrews chapter 13 discusses this topic in particular. Hebrews 13, Hebrews chapter 13, the book of Hebrews. Hebrews 13, starting in verse 9. Do not be carried about with various and strange doctrines, for it is good that the heart be established by grace and not with foods which have not profited those who have been occupied with them. We have an altar from which those who serve the tabernacle have no right to eat. For the bodies of those beasts whose blood is brought to the sanctuary by the high priest for sin are burned outside the camp. Therefore, Messiah also, that he might sanctify the people with his own blood, suffered outside the gate. Therefore, let us go forth unto him outside the camp, bearing his reproach. For here we have no continuing city, but we seek the one to come. Therefore, by him, let us continually offer the sacrifice of praise to God that is the fruit of our lips, giving thanks to his name. But do not forget to do good and to share, for with such sacrifices God is well pleased. Obey those who rule over you, be submissive, for they watch out for your souls as those who must give account. Let them do so with joy and not with grief, for that would be unprofitable for you. What we learn from there, Hebrews chapter 13, what do we learn about sacrifices? First of all, he talks about the sin offerings that the priests offer, bulls and calves and such for community. He says they're burned outside. Which ones are burned outside?
The bull.
The bull, which is only offered for the high priest and for the community. It's those two are burned outside the camp. Everything else, all other sins from either ruler or from ordinary person, they are not burned outside the camp. So what's the Apostle Paul telling us, referring to Messiah's body and us and our offerings, burned outside the camp? Yeah, so what does that make him? It makes him either the head of all communities or a high priest. Because, right? Because only two options which are given outside the camp. So burned outside the camp. And he says, this is for sins. Note, this is not all offerings. Not all sacrifices. This is sin offering in particular. Sin offerings. There's lots of offerings. Not all of them are sin. Some of them are other reasons. We discussed Olah and Mincha offerings already. Shlemim offerings. Those are not sin offerings. The sin offering is this offering burned outside the camp. And what does he say for us to do? In verse 15, other sacrifices of praise to God that is the fruit of our lips, giving thanks to his name. So the sacrifice to God are the fruit of our lips, giving thanks to his name. Now in Hosea, which I don't know if I'll get to, I'll try to find the small book. Hosea, which is what's being quoted here, it's being paraphrased, honestly, not really a direct quote per se. He's using the term fruit, there it is. Hosea is where he's quoting from. It's where is it? Hosea chapter 14. See the whole book now. I'll do part of it. O Israel, Isaiah 14, verse 1. O Israel, return to the Lord your God, for you have stumbled because of your iniquity. Take words with you and return to the Lord. Say to him, take away all iniquity. Receive us graciously. For we will offer the sacrifices of our lips. We're sacrificing calves, by the way. It's a calf or a cow, a bull or a cow of our lips. Assyria shall not save us. We shall not ride on horses, nor we any more do the work of our hands. Saying, you are our gods. For in the fatherless finds mercy. For in the fatherless, I will heal their backsliding. I will love them freely, for my anger is turned away from him. I will be like the dew to Israel. He shall grow like the lily and lengthen his roots like Lebanon. His branches shall spread. His beauty shall be like the olive tree and his fragrance like Lebanon. Those who dwell under his shadow shall return. They shall revive like grain and grow like the vine. Their scent shall be It shall be like the wine of Lebanon. Ephraim shall say, what have I to do anymore with these idols? For I have heard and observed him. I am like a green cypress tree. Your fruit is found in me. Who is wise? Let him understand these things. Who is prudent? Let him know them. The ways, Lord, are right. The righteous walk in them, but transgressors stumble in them. So we learn from Hebrews quoting Hosea. Hosea restates this point that in verse 2, we offer the sacrifice, which is the calves, the bulls of our lips. Now, Hebrews says the fruit of our lips. The idea is, what are we offering? The bulls or offerings, bulls of our lips.
Yeah, that's
what is that? What's a bull of your lips or her lips or his lips? Yeah, what does that mean? They're words, aren't they? They're words. It's fruit. It's what words are coming out of here from you, from inside you, from coming out of you. So when we learn from these offerings, now mind you, this is not a sin offering. This is a bull offering from our lips, which is different because the sin offering Messiah took care of. So go ahead, Jeff.
It just reminded me from Mark chapter 7 when Shua was saying that, you know, it's not what goes into a man, but what comes out.
Exactly. That's the offering. What comes out. What comes out of you. That's what God says. This is your sacrifice. What's coming out of you? Offer that up. Now, when we learn and study the concept of bulls or young bulls, it is mocher, which means to burst forth with youthful strength, your offering, which is what is within inside you, the well force of your great strength within you. That's what you're offering. So what comes out of your mouth is what is the strength inside you, the bull, hence it's talking about a bull, which is supposed to be a strong animal, the strength within inside you. Oh, go right ahead. Go ahead. You may quote it right ahead.
Mine already says that.
That's great.
It says, take words with you and return to Yahuwah. Say to him, take away all crookedness and accept what is good, and we render the bulls of our lips.
Yep.
Ashur does not save us. We do not ride on horses, nor ever again do we say to the works of our hands, our mighty ones. For the fatherless finds compassion in you. I shall hear their backsliding. I shall love them spontaneously, for my displeasure has turned away from him. I shall be like dew of Israel. He shall blossom like the lily and strike out his roots like Lebanon. His branches shall spread, and his splendor shall be like an olive tree, and his fragrance like Lebanon. The rest of this reads like yours.
The first part of it is a little different, but it's still good. It's correct. The point while he's describing here is you're bursting forth these great things. That's your strength. That's what you're lifting up to God. Your sacrifice of your lips is bringing forth all the lengthening your roots, everything being green like a cypress tree. It's because you offer what was your lips, the strength within you, and what does God give you as a result? The great blessings of being fruitful. the great things that we after, we're after and desiring. So we understand that when Paul's talking about the burnt of the camp, referring to the sin offering themselves. Who among us does not offer to God our lips? We all offer him something from our lips. So if it is our strength from our lips, we're offering our sacrifice. Whether it be Christian or Jew makes a difference. So every Christian, every Jew who offers strength from their lips, declaring God how great he is and how wonderful he's helped you and taken care of you, you're praising him. That is your offering. So we still do offerings, don't we? Every one of us do, don't we? We don't have an altar. We don't pour blood out. But we pour our life out through our words and our strength to God. That's our offering. So every Christian, every Jew still does sacrifices. Yeah, sacrifice of praise. This particular offering. There's other offerings too. I won't get to all of them. There's dance offerings. There's other singing offerings. I think which we won't get to all the different offering choices and how they're broken apart. Yes, Jeff.
Yeah, still do them, but always did do them.
Yes, yes, always did do. There's no time which we didn't. Even before the temple was destroyed, they still did these things. The prophets discussed it. People still offer them. They weren't. A poor person has a certain amount. You always have words that can come out of your mouth, assuming you can speak. You still offer that. That's still your great strength. We've always done that. Hence, God is desiring of those offerings. Does that make sense? Okay, I need to take a break because we have to do a new moon, so I went almost half hour overtime. I apologize. Yes, Larry.
I just want to say something about this. If you do more good than bad, then you're okay. Because the scripture doesn't support
that. No, it does not. Scripture does not support that.
You can do all kinds of good, and then do one bad, and you're out.
And you're out, exactly. Yeah.
It's in Ezekiel.
Yes. Yeah. The teachings of the philosophies are creations of men. We do that. We create things that make ourselves right. I apologize I didn't get into really to Tuscan that much about the good and bad. It's a philosophy that people teach. It's not a biblical philosophy. It's just a philosophy. Yeah. Yeah. Your good and bad doesn't work out that way. I mean, in the Torah points on the same thing, that, hey, isn't it because your goodness that this is successful? I'm choosing because of my promise to somebody else. You're not that great of a person. Yeah. It's what matters, yeah. You're all the way through the end, not halfway through or quit. It's a way of life.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. Hallel.info.